Bye.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview people who are making a positive difference in the world, and we explore important aspects and areas of life, everything from business, sales, mental, relationships, disabilities, family, spiritual, physical, and everything else you can think of. My name's Tom Tuttle Cunningham. I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. I spoke at the 2012 Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia, where I shared the stage with Deepak Chopra, who was a keynote speaker at that event. I'll be speaking in a few days on Thursday in Del Mar, California at the Think and Grow Rich Summit. I'm sharing the stage with some of the Hall of Fame speakers of the world, some amazing people. I've had a rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. And that's 44 years now. And in that time, I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced, and I've been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1", and that's due to the heavy daily doses of the oral steroid prednisone that I had to take to fight my arthritis. And despite those physical challenges, I always answer amazing when asked how I'm doing. Find out more about me at my website. It's Tom, the number 2, and Tall, TALL.com. I am extraordinarily excited. My guest today is Dr. Judith Shamayan. I will be flat out and tell everybody I am a big fan of Dr. Shamayan. I'll make sure I pronounce it right. Shamayan, there you go. So Dr. Shamayan is President Emeritus and immediate past President and CEO of the Victorian Order of Nurses, V-O-N. They've been around forever. How long, Judith, have they been around, Victorian Order of Nurses?
115 years.
115 years. Okay. So she's also the immediate past president of the Canadian Nurses Association. You heard I've been in hospital 40 times. My favorite people are nurses. She's also a professor at the Lawrence Bloomberg Faculty of Nursing at the University of Toronto, a co-investigator with the Nursing Health Services Research Unit. She was previously the executive director of the Office of Nursing Policy at Health Canada, vice president of nursing at Mount Sinai Hospital, and has held various academic positions since 1989. I've had numerous surgeries at Mount Sinai Hospital, and Judith knows Dr. Gross, my surgeon there quite well and has worked with him. She received her PhD from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, her master's in public health from New York University, her baccalaureate in community nursing from Concordia University. This is an amazing one. Recipient of the Golden Jubilee Medal 2002 from the Governor General of Canada, the Award of Merit from CNA and the Canadian Federation of Nurses Union, and she is the recipient of 3 honorary degrees. Where I found her was, she was listed as one of Canada's most powerful women, top 100 award from the Women's Executive Network, and I subsequently end up writing a story about a VON in the Canadian Business Journal. And so she's currently campaigning to become president of the International Council of Nurses. And if anyone asks my opinion, I would vote for her. I think I'm going to join just so I can vote for her. Judith, welcome to the show today. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Tom. You are an inspiration to all of us.
Wow, I even forgot to mention you were on Undercover Boss recently too, right?
Yeah, but I have to tell you that meeting you in person and seeing how you face life with that positive energy in spite of all your challenges that you just kind of rattle off 1, 2, 3 is quite amazing, and you are my hero.
And we know some of the same people from Mount Sinai. And I did also a story on your good friend Judith Skelton Green. And what is her organization? Nursing One, right?
Yeah, she and a couple of colleagues are running the Dorothy Wiley Institute to groom current and future leaders, both in nursing and other areas.
Neat. Now, before the show, and one of the, well, the number one principle of what Napoleon Hill teaches is what's called definiteness of purpose, where if you really know what your God-given definite purpose, because some people think their definite purpose be a movie star or actress or a world-famous athlete, possible, but not always. But whatever your God-given definite purpose is the most important thing to discover, find out, and pursue. And I was saying before we went on air, campaigning for International Council of Nurses, I said I would have been happy, my legacy would have been happy with all of the things you've already done in your life. And I imagine as you get older, you know, you have some of the same challenges. You're not have as much energy. You don't have as much time for all the different things. But truly, you must have a purpose in your life to create a legacy and make a difference while you're here, because you have to forego a lot of things to pursue the things that you do, right?
Yes and no. I pursue the things that I believe are aligned with my values and make a difference. My definitive purpose is to use every day to make a difference in this world and make this world a better place for people. So I don't feel I forgo things. I will not enjoy lying on the beach for 2 weeks and so on. But I love to meet people and travel while I work. So I think on the happiness scale and the self-actualization scale, I am probably off the chart.
I love it. And when my wife and I have been married 5 years, when we went on our honeymoon, we went to Dominican Republic. After 2 days of sitting by the pool, I said, oh, we're not going to do one of these again. I can't sit by a pool or by a beach. It is not my way of relaxing like yourself. I love to be around people. And so what a great legacy that you're creating. Another thing I was thinking of, Napoleon Hill wrote a lot about mastermind, working together in harmony. And he said the greatest masterminds, and he gave examples, Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, were with husband and wife. Best if it can be that way, he said. And for you to pursue the things you do, I'm just thinking as a husband and pretty proud guy and busy guy, you must really have to have a great partnership with your husband to pursue passionately the things you have done, because it really would take a time commitment, I imagine, and a really good equal exchange of everything going on at home. And so talk about that, because, you know, most men would be proud to have a career like yours, but they might be not as proud if their wife had the career as theirs, or, you know, they're, and yet you've been married a long time. You're at home right now with your husband. And so talk about that, because that's important in people's lives to really pursue their purpose and their passion. They really need to have that mastermind at home, right?
You're absolutely right, Tom. What fascinates me is that when I speak to groups of women who are beginning or mid-career, and I talk about my life because they want to hear about how you become so successful and at the same time you're so committed to your family and so on, the time I get the biggest applause is when I tell them that I am married to the same man for 42 years.
Whoa.
They find that pretty incredible. I married when I was 20, really have not had a vision of purpose at that point. It was just a young, go-lucky, married this handsome guy, and really my life has been very rich, and it has been very rich because the incredible support and cheering that both myself and our three daughters, we have three daughters who are all married and successful, been getting from my husband, who always was just cheering us on to keep going and accomplishing more and more. And he never put himself in the front of the pack. He was a cheerleader. He's amazing, and he's continuing to do that in many different ways. And I can spend a whole hour talking about it, but I don't think you would want me to do that. But simply saying you're absolutely correct, and you need to appreciate and value and be grateful for having such a relationship and never take it for granted.
Amen, amen, amen. I love it, I love it. And then also we were talking beforehand. I introduced you to a friend for trying to do some work with Vaughn. I worked with this man, Howard Rosenberg. Both of his parents were Holocaust survivors. And I didn't see Undercover Boss, but you were telling me that your parents are not alive, but they were featured in there as to your incentive or desire to create a legacy. And we didn't even get to talk about that before we got on the air. So tell me a bit about your parents to raise someone like yourself who practically gives of their life for service to others.
So both of my parents are Holocaust survivors. The story of my father is more tragic than that of my mother. My father was married and had seven children. Seven. And both his first wife and all of the seven children perished. So he came back and lost a very large family, but his own immediate family. He was only around 39 when he came back from the Holocaust and married my mother, who was his age, who was not married before. And they had an only child, and that's me. And they brought me up in an incredible way. When you talk to your friend Howard or others, there are two types of Holocaust survivor parents. One type that constantly talks about it, and you grow up feeling really guilt-ridden or whatever, and others that don't really talk about it. My parents belong to the second one. But deep down, as I talked to my mother later in life, she grew up in a very wealthy family, was very spoiled. And going through the Holocaust was very, very hard for her. And she was determined to raise her only child to have character and perseverance and resilience, that if I ever would have to go through something so terrible in my life, I have the tools to cope with it. And thank God we don't have to go through those things, but those characters and those determinations have serve me day in and day out.
Wow. Judith, what I'm talking about on Thursday and the main topic I talk about is learning from adversity and defeat, because in life, probably about 5% of us will become independently wealthy, well-known. But all of us will endure suffering, will endure some adversity, and will endure some defeat. And if you learn the characteristic, the mental and thought processes and emotions to deal with that, you are prepared to succeed in and through anything. Because a lot of things, horrible things happen to people unexpectedly, sometimes deserving, sometimes not. But if you have that ability to get through adversity and defeat and remain positive and directed toward your purpose, there's probably no greater skill in the world, right?
And I guess if you look at your audience on Thursday, there would be some that are either children of immigrants or immigrants themselves. Mm-hmm. So I see a lot of those qualities in my travels internationally, and I am amazed when I go to Africa, Asia, Europe, regardless where you go in the world, of how resourceful and resilient people are to try to turn bad situations or difficult situations to better situations. But the closest we can go with those that have not left North America is to look at immigrant families, and so often the first generation of immigrants, pay such a heavy price, and they work so hard so their children have a better future, a better living, and so on. So I don't think we need to go very far to learn and see, but we need to open our eyes. We cannot be narrow-minded and live in a small box. We need to ask, we need to listen, and we need to watch. And people who could inspire us every day.
Amen. And I'm thinking of a family in my church, the husband and wife. They came from Argentina with $200, worked hard, amazing kids that contribute to the world in big ways. And you think, wow, $200. I'm nervous if I go to a town with just $200 on me, let alone another country. And then also, one of the, obviously when you answer amazing every time, people are going to ask you why. Here's what I tell them. 40% of the world live on less than $2 a day. And you and I are nice people, but we are no more deserving to be born in Canada, North America, a developed country, than someone is deserving to earn $2 a day. And my mom and my sister do a lot of medical mission work. And when they tell me the stories of what people endure in those countries, boy, anything you complain about in North America, you should be ashamed of, right?
Yeah, but we all forget. I used to do much more international work, and every time I came back, I used to say the same thing to my staff, whether it was at Mount Sinai or others, that we have no idea what lack of something means. You have to go to some of those countries. But we all get used to our own reality. You know, we all drive with the car, and you look at the car beside you. We all have a home, and we look at the home beside us, and so on. So I think while we have some humility, looking outside of our own box will help us to see and reaffirm that we are here for a purpose, and we are privileged, and we have a responsibility to others.
Exactly. We have a responsibility, and we are privileged. So I measure success at the end of the year. You know, when you examine a year, I look at how much time, money, and wisdom did I give away. And, you know, that's a nice measure for success. The more I'm blessed, I should be able to bless more with my time, money, and wisdom. And so I really like your thinking on that. Now, the International Council of Nurses, that would be kind of interesting, and we talked about that would involve, like, a lot of travel and comparing, I guess, the different healthcare systems and processes in different countries. And although I thought at first that might involve a lot of differences, you had mentioned that really a lot of it is the same. It is a human body, so the ways to treat it are, the effective ways to treat it are fairly similar around the world, but perhaps all the different systems and processes to do that and serve that healthcare system may be different. And so this, again, is going to involve travel and people that maybe languages you don't speak. And so, again, I'm tired just reading your biography, let alone living it. And so when is this election? Tell me what you would really enjoy. Why is it that instead of sitting at home and visiting grandchildren and bugging your husband that you're going for the president of the International Council of Nurses?
So the International Council of Nurses is the global organization that brings together the nursing organizations from 136 countries. The head office is in Geneva, but really it has 7 regions and, as I said, 136 countries. The purpose is to work in collaboration to provide a global message around issues that related to healthcare and to nursing and how nurses can contribute to building a stronger and better healthcare system, which will build stronger and better countries. Mm-hmm. The elections happen once in 4 years. This year it's happening on May 18th, so say a little prayer for me. In Australia, And there is a meeting that takes place every 4 years. And before the meeting, there is this annual business meeting of the member countries. Each country has one vote. And this time, there are three different countries that have candidates for the presidency role. And I am very privileged to be the Canadian candidate. And I am hoping to be the successful candidate. None of us run for election to lose. We all run to win.
Yes.
Because there is so much that we need to do internationally. And as you indicated, my previous experiences are solid, both internationally, nationally, in government, hospitals, research and teaching. And it's really the pinnacle of how I can make a difference for 4 years working with world organizations like the World Bank and the World Health Organization, United Nations, and with the nursing organizations all over the world.
Wow. And those are some amazing organizations. And yet anyone who's listening, anyone with a brain knows that unlike, let's say, a political party, you're going after this for the legacy creation. You don't need the money. You don't need the job. You don't need to be away so much and traveling like crazy. But you're doing this from your heart. Really, I cannot see any other purpose or reason why you would do this. So you're doing it because of the legacy you want to create that your parents taught you to create and to help on a global scale, not even just in North America.
So this is a volunteer job. You don't get...
Volunteer? Volunteer job. Oh, man. All right. Okay. I didn't even know that. Wow.
It's a labor of love.
Very good. Oh, wow. So this is a big position. That's a volunteer position. Now, as you said, you get to travel the world. And what I found is that people are really amazing. And it's so interesting to learn cultures and processes and their thinking and how their systems work. And that will be a lot of fun. And so it'll be interesting and to be able to collaborate and put together systems that really affect the world. That will be a lot of fun. Now, when people hear of those things, those organizations that you mentioned that you get to work with, they don't see behind the scenes because, like, even just for the speaking engagement, you got to take like 2 flights, leave early, take forever to get there, change time zones, and people just say, ooh, wow, you're going to work with the World Bank? It's like, yeah, but it's going to take me like 2 days to get there with 10 time zone changes. And so a labor of love with no pay, traveling the world with crazy time zones to make a difference in people's lives. And I believe, from my experience in the healthcare system, nurses are the most hands-on. That's who people spend the most time with. They spend more time with a nurse than with a doctor, with a physio, with a surgeon. Name anybody in the healthcare system. If you're in it and involved and need help, you have spent more time with a nurse than you've spent with anybody else, I think.
You're totally correct. But unfortunately, in spite of that, what I see, I personally experienced it, and what I hear everywhere in the world, in spite of all that, and in spite of the fact that nurses have a lot of the solutions to how to deal with healthcare issues, both specifically but also system-wise, too often nurses are not sitting around the decision-making tables, and everybody loses by it.
Yes. Exactly. I even see that in a hospital, that they're not treated with sometimes the honor, respect, and admiration that they deserve. But who knows more about the patient on a day-to-day basis than the nurse?
And also, nurses are the ones who interact with the family. And as you well know, Tom, the families are playing a very, very important role in the care of individuals. Today there was some discussion in the radio about some new research that shows that even in our country, 10% of the children are primary caregivers. They look after a sick mother or a sick father or a sick sibling and so on. And nurses are an incredible vehicle to support that, but also to provide advice on how to set up systems, how to organize funding, how to manage the healthcare policy to make sure that we make the best use of the resources that we have. And I don't know if the chance to look at or talk to anyone, but the Canadian Nursing Association, when I was the president of the association, last June 2012, released an amazing document that talked about how we need to get our healthcare system aligned and make sure that we get good outcome from the investments we make, because we don't look well on the international sphere when you compare how much money we put into the system and what we get out of it on the social arenas and the health arena. And nurses have a lot of the solutions. So I hope that through the role in ICN, if I get elected, I can bring some of that research, some of that voice, some of that desire to be part of the solution and make a difference to those tables. And I hope it will be accepted. And I hope that 4 years after I finish my presidency, the world will look different.
And when you make nurses better, you make the whole healthcare system better. And nurses are such a great resource, because I was just thinking, like, for instance, as a, you know, thinking of families I know, in any circumstance, healthcare, a lot of them, there are numerous options as to how you can treat it. And the family has their opinions on which are good or better or should be pursued. And often the nurse is a great person to explain the benefits, both sides of what the family wants to do, what the patient wants to do, and what the doctors want to do. And you know, that is a great resource, because everybody's going to have questions. Even if a doctor tells them they have to do something, they have their own questions. And to have a nurse to say, this procedure you're thinking, oh, that's good, it works this, it has this challenge, but, you know, a lot of people do it because of this, and this one, well, not so good. It is really valuable. And also, as you mentioned, they have access or know of the resources, and Canada is so blessed with social services for people with challenges. They are often very plugged into those arenas for people to get help. And so they are not only a medical provider, but they're a resource for a family as well, right?
Absolutely. Tom, if we take your story with the hip replacement, if you can take 5 patients that had hip replacement, if you take yourself, you take somebody who's 90 years old, you take somebody who had an accident and is 40 years old and is a construction worker or whatever, the way they will have to be managed post-surgery is totally different. There is no similarities beside, okay, they will recover from their surgery. But if you are a homeless person who fallen on ice and has hip surgery versus if you have a family that is built in and is supportive of you and so on, and all of those things must be taken into account by somebody. And that somebody is a nurse. And that somebody will be able and has to navigate and help the family and the system, both within the hospital, in the home care arena, and others. So, and in order to build the structure, we have such a fragmented healthcare system. If you put nurses into the room of designing the right system for the patient, you will get amazing results, because the nurses are not interested in it for themselves. They are interested in it for the patient's sake.
Exactly. And a lot of times you have people designing systems and processes that are not working hand in hand with patients. And so if you're not working hand-in-hand with a patient, how can you design a system or a process? You're designing it for efficiency. You're not designing it for the optimum healthcare experience of the patient.
I think what people need to understand that the optimum experience of the patient and family and optimum care is the cost-effective care, because everything else will lead to people coming back to emergency room, losing work because they don't know what to do and so on. And far too often, we see it in home care, we see it with VON. People are sent home and they don't really know what needs to be done. Nobody really, maybe they told them or maybe they gave them a piece of paper,
mm-hmm.
but that's not sufficient. And then you see medication errors. You remember the discussions that we had on CBC on Fifth Estate recently and
mm-hmm.
other reports on all kind of errors. And it's because the system and the providers do not have the time or do not understand that the focus has to be empowering the patient and the family, giving them the tools, the knowledge, the experience. And we need to make sure that nurses have the time and the knowledge and the opportunity to do it.
I love that. And when I do Arthritis Society workshops, I tell people, you are the center of your healthcare team. You are the decision maker. Doctors are great, very smart, well-educated. They're part of your team. They're not God. Physiotherapists are good, but in the end, you make the decisions about what you feel is appropriate for your health care. And I've seen on numerous doctors' charts myself referred to as a non-compliant patient, which is a nice way of saying that I don't do what they say or ask me to do all the time. And it's because I evaluate, you know, what a doctor says, what a nurse says, what a surgeon says with, does that fit my lifestyle? Can I get back to work quicker? What if my only physiotherapy I want to do is get upstairs and drive my car and go to work? And so I've made decisions that had doctors agitated and surgeons. But in the end, if as long as you have a smart enough patient who can really evaluate their part in their treatment, they should be the ones in control of the choices they make for their treatment, right?
But there is also the system issue. I have, we have done a piece of work that we've seen physicians saying this patient is not compliant because they don't show up for their appointment. And when we try to track it down, the patient is very compliant. They made arrangements for somebody to pick them up to go to see the doctor, but that person
mm-hmm.
didn't show up. They had they had no transportation to get to the doctor. And if we don't understand that it takes more to put, to organize and support patients and families, and we don't do it, then we run into this notion of saying, oh, this person is this or that. And it's not about the provider. It is about the patient, the client, and the immediate family that supports that individual.
Wow, I hadn't even thought about the getting to the appointment because, oh, man, I had a ankle fusion surgery. Really nasty. I had to take in Ottawa the public handicap bus. I think it's Paratranspo, maybe it's called there. And I thought this was a disgrace. I've been driving since I'm 16. And if you need to get to work at 9 o'clock, you either have to get there at like 8 or 7:30. You can't, it's not like driving a car where you can time it and get to work. And if you have, same with a doctor's appointment, if you have a 10 o'clock one and you're relying on those handicap buses, you got to get there either way before or apologize for arriving late. And so, yeah, if you know that ahead of time, the healthcare system is well served to ensure they get there in time for their appointment. Otherwise, you've, as far as efficiency of the system, you've lost a time slot where you could have been seeing someone and that person did want to get there, but you know, with their handicap bus system, they either had to get there 2 hours early or a half hour late. So, yeah, gee, I hadn't even thought of that end of the spectrum as well, too.
But that's exactly the point, that providing health care, receiving health care, is far more than the medical intervention. And that breadth of thinking is understood very well by nurses. And if they are part of the decision-making, policy design, and engaged in the conversation, they can bring it to the table. But they have to be at the table to bring it to the table.
Why do you think they're not invited to those tables?
I don't know. I think there is a lot of different research and different opinions. Some would say that some of it has to do with gender issues. There's still mostly women.
Yes.
In the hospital setting, there is a age-long tension between the power of physicians versus everybody else.
Yep, I've seen this.
I guess some of the scientists talk about keeping middle class. Nurses are so busy that they barely able to pick their head and get themselves pushed through the door because they are busy looking after the patients.
Yeah.
So there are multiple factors to it.
Judith, that's the one I kind of miss the most. You know, when I was diagnosed, let's say when I was in hospital in Ottawa in my teens, Dr. Walton James, and nurses had time to make
right.
you laugh, talk to you, find out what was bothering you. If it was a night shift, whatever that one was, you know, 11 to 7, you know, if you're awake and in pain and a young person and wanted to play a game of checkers, they could come in and out throughout the night and play. You don't, now if you're in hospital, that nurse is in and out of there faster than you can turn your head. And it's not because she wants to be. It's just that they're very, 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 very short-staffed, right?
It really is an epidemic. It's really a huge problem. And it leads to nurses being very unhappy because
mm-hmm.
people go into nursing because they want to be helpful. Nurses are extremely knowledgeable. The nurses we educate now and those that are in the caregiving positions know more than any previous generation knew. And they want to use that knowledge. They understand the importance of caring and therapeutic relationships and having relationships and so on. But they don't have time for it. And it's really a tragedy. Because in the end of the day, it goes circles back, full circle to our conversation. If they don't have the time to do what needs to be done with the patient will not know, is not empowered, the family is not empowered, and they don't know what they don't know. And it just boomerangs back into the emergency room or lack of proper recovery and so on. So the system needs a lot of work. But also, a lot of the system needs to be strengthened at the primary healthcare arena. And again,
yes.
I think we don't fully understand the importance of having a family physician or a nurse practitioner. We need to have a very strong primary care setting because they are the ones that should be overseeing and managing of all the other issues.
Amen. And I have an amazing family physician, tremendous. And I was thinking my mom, when we got older, she became a RNA. I don't know if it's still called that anymore, registered nursing assistant. And she said the reason she did that rather than an RA was she wanted to be bedside working and hands-on with a patient. And she said a lot of nurses spend a lot of time in paperwork. And that was not her desire. And so I imagine even today, paperwork probably is as bad or worse than it's ever been, even though we're in a wireless society, supposedly.
I think the paperwork is important. You want to make sure, whether it's electronic or paper, that the information about you is documented. So mm-hmm. the next person who comes to take care of you knows about it. And if, God forbid, something happens, they can track back of what happened and what was given to you, what procedure was done, and so on. So I don't think we can ever have a profession, whether it's being a teacher, a nurse, a lawyer, a doctor, without that documentation.
Yes.
But the system is not efficient enough. What will people say, and you probably experienced it yourself, you go into a hospital, and maybe before admission, they ask you 500 questions, and they write it down, and they take the signs and so on.
I know where this is going. They ask you the same questions.
The very same question.
Exactly. It is annoying.
The same address. You know, your height is the same height. Your weight is the same weight.
Yes.
Come on, let's get on with it.
Come on. 2 weeks ago, I gave you those 500 pieces of information. And, like, now you want to ask me again. And Judith, imagine me with my arthritis. Unique case. And I'm in teaching hospitals. And this was before electronic medical records. So every student would come in, seemed like separately, seemed like they refused to come in together, and they would ask me, blah, 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 and then, okay, then the next guy come in, same questions. You're like, oh my gosh, I used to actually seriously think about writing it all out, making copies, and passing it to whoever asked.
Absolutely.
And so with electronic medical record, you ask it, you answer it once, it happens to you once, it's recorded, somebody can look at it. This is an annoying part of the system, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think there are a lot of efficiencies that can be built in into the system and free up some more time for nurses to do what they can do better than anybody else, and having that incredible, important relationship with the patient, so the patient can be able to learn to look after themselves.
Very good. Now, Judith, suppose after or on this date in May, people have some crazy, wild delusions and they don't pick you crazy. What do you go back to now? Would you go back with the VON? Would you find a beach where you could be bored? Will you find a different project to pursue? Of course, they're going to pick you, but you should have to just have a little plan B in case something happens to their thinking on that day.
Absolutely. And the plan B is, I don't want to work for money anymore. I have done 32 years of progressively senior management, finishing with being the CEO, the Chief Executive Officer of VON, which is a huge organization. I am involved with several other initiatives. And then I have a couple of my own ideas of what I would like to do in advancing women and nurses in being more involved in senior level of boards and positions and so on. So if I find myself finding some free time, I'm going to pursue an issue that's been an issue for me and wanting to work on for many years and just build that agenda.
Wow. So you're going to be busy anyway. And I just actually wrote down as a goal a few weeks ago, and you're even going to beat that one. I wrote down I want to reverse tithe. I want to give 90 and keep 10. You're going to be giving 100 when you work for free with the amount that you could earn, and you take that into account. That's 100% tithing. That's a lot of tithing, and mostly tithing creates a legacy and helps other people. And so, regardless of what happens after May, what's the date?
18.
18th, so I'm putting it in my performance planner to say the extra
prayers. Yeah, the results come out May 19, but the elections are on May 18.
Okay, May 19. May 17th, I'll be praying. May 19th, I'll be on that website checking it out. And even if I don't see your name, I won't shed a tear because I know that you'll have 7 other projects on the go the very next day.
I am a very strong believer of things happen for a reason. And if I get elected, the minute I get elected, real hard work starts for 4 years, and
yeah.
I would be very happy. If I don't get elected, real hard work starts that day, and I will be very happy.
And it'll go on till the last day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Amen.
As long
Amen.
As I
God,
can do
when,
things that matter.
Exactly. When God gives you a purpose in your heart that you believe in, it never seems like work, and you never want to retire.
Absolutely. You got it.
Amen. Amen. Thanks so much, Judith. I appreciate it so much. I am such a huge fan of yours and all the various organizations you've worked in, and continue to give your life to serve others as a legacy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and good luck to all of you.
Thank you. Take care.